This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat is still off today, but we are joined by a very, very interesting guest today. She is a musician, author, historian, Saidah Rastam, and we're going to talk about popular culture as alternative history. You may have heard of her work largely around the rediscovery of the roots to our national anthem, Negaraku, but she has plenty more to offer from where that came from, so it'll be an exciting show. Welcome, Saidah.
Thank you.
So let's start with getting to know you a little bit better. You approach history from a variety of perspectives. And the one that interests me most is your background as a musician. Maybe you can introduce yourself to us with a little bit of that. And then how that led you to do some really interesting research on our history.
Okay. Well, I've always liked playing by ear. I don't like sight reading. So yeah, I like composing since I was very little. When it came to doing a degree, my parents felt I should do law rather than music. So off I went, got a degree in law, came back, practiced at the bar for 8 years. After that, I felt it was time to actually do music. And so that's what I did. I left the law firm and joined a music production company and learned how to switch on a computer and create music through computers.
Yeah, I wonder too, at that point, it wasn't an easy decision to make, right? Because if you have a standard Asian upbringing, they say, you know, stick to what's safe, a profession that will guarantee you a livelihood. And music, never mind like the economic insecurity, but also the social stigma, is something that parents would generally discourage their children to do. So what was that like, switching tracks like that?
Well, I remember one incident very well. As a lawyer, of course, you get invited to all these five-star hotel functions. And then the first month that I was a musician, we went to a hotel to do a gig. And so waiting to do it, I sat down at the round table, you know, took my bag out. And the waiter came and told me that I had walked through the wrong place. I should have walked through the kitchen. And there's no way I mess up the table settings there.
Wow.
Yeah. Kena halau.
Right.
So that was, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. But did you maintain an interest in history at that point too? Like, was it just something you read on the side? Or was your curiosities about our past something you developed much later?
Dad always said, look to the future, don't look to the past. Mm. Past is a luxury, and we don't have that as a young nation. So when I grew up, nobody spoke about history in my family. It was only in the last 3 years that I learned amazing things. Just by researching the music of Malaya, I came across stuff about my own family, which, you know, amazed me. How come nobody talks about this? That one of my ancestors was the first Kapitan Melayu of Melaka, appointed by the Dutch. Another one was the Datuk Panglima Kinta, who actually was with Sultan Idris when they made that historic trip to London, where apparently the national anthem was created, Perak anthem was created. Mm-hmm. Another one was another grandfather, was actually one of the first batch of graduates of the Sultan Idris Training College and taught there along with people like Ahmad Bustamam and Harun Amin Rashid. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you know, that led to that whole radical movement, Kesatuan Melayu Muda, Melayu Raya and all that. So, I mean, these things to me are amazing.
Yeah.
How could we not even have talked about that? And I had to learn it from Museum Negara and Arkib Negara.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing about doing history in Malaysia, in that you realise that A, so much is under research, right? There's so much more to discover. And B, so much of it is actually within reach, right? Granted, there's still blind spots, you know, there's still a lot of areas that are under pursued. But for the most part, the starting points are already like quite rich. There's a lot for us to work with if we just look at, like you say, museums and archives, even small towns, right? Like in Perak in particular, I was taking a road trip through the state 2 months ago. And I realized that, I mean, Perak, you know, you had the earlier cities there and stuff. Even the small town museums will have the interesting photo, the kind of awkward artifact that tells you that, well, there's so much there, but we somehow don't value it enough.
Yes, thank you for saying that. That was my experience as well, mm-hmm. Finding out about music of Malaya. Actually, that project started because I found that you couldn't find out about these songs that we knew so well, when they were created, mm-hmm. who composed them, all these things. And so, like BBC or other places, you can just go into the archives and find out. Here, there was nothing. So I started doing that, and I found that in that research process, some of the gems were actually just sitting in people's cupboards, wow. and albums, and some of the most amazing discoveries and clues could be found from there, as you say, in small museums and, mm-hmm. and awkward artifacts, rather than the official histories.
Yeah. The interesting thing that struck me about your research on Negaraku in particular was that you took a social turn, right? So you could do the standard music history. And you did that. There's the lineage of possible sources of Negaraku, right? Who wrote it, where the melody was first heard and where it was popular and stuff like that. But you went to look at how it affected people's lives, right? So the rickshaw puller who whistles the tune. And you said that the song captures the moment, the feeling of that turning point in history. So music is not just something catchy or nice in the background. It's something that moves bodies, right? And when you locate it at that crucial period in our history, that song is not just a song, it's really a statement of our affects, you know. So what made you take your research in that direction than rather just stay contained within musical frames?
Well, one thing was the caliber of the music. I had committed to spending some time doing this project. But what I found was a lot of it was sentimentality. Mm. If you took it out of the Malayan frame and memories, collective memory, you played it for somebody internationally, they wouldn't give the same value to it that we give, simply because a lot of the music is 4/4 and were pop songs of their day, mm-hmm. filled with sometimes even mawkish sentiments. So, I mean, that is, the songs were pretty, but gradually, I found that the more amazing story was the amazing people behind it. Mm-hmm. These were ordinary people creating amazing music, very viral music, in extraordinary times. So the circumstances behind it, for example, the fact that a new nation was being born, and again, that was 1957, and then again in 1963, you know, the whole turbulence behind that. Now, the musicians there were at the forefront of our nation's quest for modernity. Mm-hmm. And then that became the more compelling story. People like Saiful Bahri, mm-hmm. who crossed over from Indonesia to come here, the enemy country, as it were, looking every night at assassins, which he imagined were in the vicinity. People like P. Ramlee, mm-hmm. already a great star in Singapore, who came back as part of this national anthem effort. Alfonso Suliano, who had played Bangsawan music ever since the age of 7, wow. sleeping on stages, going up and down the country, by now, in near the 1950s, a major figure in the music-making efforts of the young Radio Malaya, and many, many other figures. So the music was one thing, but there was something bigger happening behind that.
That's an interesting observation, because we, I think today, right, we tend to think of politics and popular music as separate worlds. But back then, if you look at the figures themselves and the time that they were producing their works, they couldn't help but to absorb the political atmosphere into their craft, right? Because it was just independence. There was so much uncertainty about where their country was going to go. Even the idea of Malaysia at that time was still imagined. It was like, okay, where was this going to go? But then again, I'm an artist. How can I speak to this atmosphere? So artists just had to respond to history.
It's true. Interesting. Goodness, Fuad, talking to you is amazing.
Thank you.
This is really true. You know what? I have often suspected, doing this music research, that the music which is retained today was only a very small amount, and that made it into the recordings of Radio Malaya. which, if you imagine, was not the stuff which was happening in the cabarets and in the fun fairs and in entertainment parks, Jubilee Park, etc., which was where a lot of entertainment happened. Again, in Singapore, that was happening. In the daytime, people would work in the official music studios, for example, creating film scores. At night was when they went to the entertainment parks, the great parks. And that was where people like D. Hamzah, later the more restrained and respectable Hamzah Dolmat, were creating things like Joget Modern, where people and legislators were saying should not be, you know, I mean, this was not lock up your daughters sort of thing. So when we talk about the music which remains on LPs today, as you say, it's a very small amount of music. And what interests me is what music was happening then, what made people jive, and how can we discover that even today at that late stage? How can we discover the alternative music, as it were? Now, when you talk about bringing it within politics, there would have been cross trajectories, definitely, because at that time, you know, KL was so small. So Tunku would have been sitting in the Selangor Club where Alfonso Soliana was playing. It literally was a meeting of music and politics, literally.
One of the interesting characters that you mention is Saiful Bahri.
Yes.
He sounds like he's larger than life. I mean, even the brief description you gave me was just fascinating. He was a spy. He was escaping Indonesia. And then he wrote another, you know, iconic song. These are characters that you think are only realistic in like spy novels or, you know, a Humphrey Bogart movie or something, you know. But, you know, he's part of our history too. And it's really refreshing to see such lives having lived here.
Truly. One of the things which I found quite weird was how much disinformation there was on the internet masquerading as authoritative information. Everybody gets really assertive and trenchant about things, but it's all wrong. And people are copy and pasting and having huge fights over that. Now, when you talk about an Indonesian, as Saiful Bahri was, you're going to get the other stream of internet abuse as well coming from across the seas. So it was good to actually get down and dirty and find out from his family here what it was, find out from people who had worked with him in Film Negara what it was like. And he was truly fascinating.
An interesting point you mentioned was about how music was really this expression of modernization, right? That when capturing the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, musicians felt that their works were really trying to understand that. One scene that came to mind was this iconic moment in Antara Dua Darjat, the Getaran Jiwa moment. People forget how radical the origin of that song was, right? Because here you have the poor man teaching the daughter of a rich aristocrat the piano. And I guess the chemistry was captured by how quickly she learned the song, you know, which is, you know, if you hear it too, you can tell it's quite complicated, the melody and the arrangement. But because they were so in love, I guess the mood transferred very fast. And then you had like a very Western musical instrument bringing the two classes together. And you have basically history embodied in that interaction, right? And it also questioned feudal allegiances, saying that it's a new time. You just can't separate people. But what's going to bring them together? It's pop culture. It's pop music.
True. But in that case, I wonder whether that was seen as golongan atasan music. I mean, how many people had a piano?
That's true.
And could sit there in, as I remember, she had quite a bustier number. That I'm not sure. And that whole introduction was ripped off from a Hong Kong song, as it were. So it was that, at that time, may have been perceived as imported music. I don't know. Although today is part of our thing. But speaking of culture and bringing things together, I think, you know, what I mentioned, this notion of Tunku looking for a national anthem, this anthem was so important. It had to identify, it had to actually represent his new nation. And to me, it's looking back, you know, he had compositions from the likes of Benjamin Britten. William Walton had been invited. He wrote the processional march for the coronation of Queen Elizabeth. I mean, major international figures were invited to submit their compositions. In the end, Tunku Abdul Rahman chose a song which actually hit the hearts and the guts mm-hmm. of Malayans. He didn't go for a prestigious song. Mm-hmm. Now, for me, that says a lot about the leader and his aspirations for the country.
And to me, too, it says a lot about how people could resonate with the atmosphere of that time, you know, that this song was something that people on the streets would hum. And they could then connect that rhythm with the broader national picture. So when I heard that account from you, then it made me think back to that moment, because we always, we get just maybe the visual picture of it through these grainy black and white photos and then that famous clip, right? But I always wonder, okay, that's that one guy on the stage, but what was it like, you know? And I don't want to get into the sentimental thing about Malays, Chinese and Indians are together, but I want to know how it was embodied, you know? Like, how did people move to that moment, right? And I think the fact that we know more about how Negaraku is situated and all that gives us a better idea of that picture. But let's take a break for now. We'll be back for the second part of the show, but we've had really a fascinating sketch of a very, very key time of our history through popular culture, which is a very common resource to understand our world. You are listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. We are joined by a musician, author, lawyer, Saidah Rastam. I'll be right back after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined this week by musician, author, lawyer, historian, Saidah Rastam, and we are talking about alternative histories via a consideration of popular culture. Her work, I guess, is most well known for giving us a fuller, richer account of Negaraku and its origins, but you've also pointed out different moments in our musical history that suggests the kinds of ways that people are waking up to the modern world, to independence, so on and so forth. A couple of things that you mentioned struck me as very fascinating. The fact that music brought people together. So Joget Modern brought boys and girls together. Of course, Negaraku brought the whole, you know, country together. But this was an emergence of a new sense of public. Right, the idea that we can relate to space differently, you know. I've always been curious about that turning point between, all right, we can at one point think of ourselves as separate kind of units, but music is really like making us learn about one another. So what are some of the insights on that aspect, on how it changed the way we related to each other?
The setting up of Radio Malaya was integral to that process. Before that, you see, the nation wasn't a nation as such. Mm-hmm. It was different states. And within those states, different provinces, dialects, sensibilities, cultures.
Interesting.
When they created the country, they had to pull everybody together in one vision. And that was pretty difficult to do. One way was to teach people to sing this one song, Negaraku. And tasked with that was Dol Ramli, and he was assisted by Alfonso Soleano on the piano and Ahmad Marikan, the producer. So together they created these programs where every day you would learn how to sing the national anthem. One line, and then Alfonso would play the tune, sing another line, etc. The idea was that if the nation could sing one song with the lyrics together, these lyrics having to personify the aims of the nation, then it would be a good unifying exercise. The lyrics, as you can imagine, were incredibly important, because even today, mm-hmm. to me, the lyrics tells me a lot about what our leaders at that time wanted, what mm-hmm. they prioritized. And the circumstances in which they were created, to me, after 2 years of research, are still a little hazy. So, the nation was fragmented. Well, at that time, it wasn't a nation. So we were talking about many, many states mm-hmm. being brought together. Can you imagine Kedah, what they spoke, and Johor, and then you've got the Straits Settlements with Queen's English, and then you've got all sorts of dialects.
Yeah.
And they had to be brought together. And the most powerful way was music.
Yeah.
Another thing that was done was the Merdeka Choir. And again, Tunku said that the Merdeka Choir, which was to sing on the Night of Independence, had to be people from Sumba Bangsa. And to me, that's very telling parity. So when they recorded the first Negaraku, they took people from churches.
Wow.
Can you imagine? Tunku said, go to the churches, because at that time, Malay music, well, still is, single line is melody, is melodic, not harmonic, not vertical. So to sing SATB, or soprano, alto, tenor, bass arrangements, Tunku's idea, actually, according to Tan Sri Ahmad Merican, was that Ahmad Merican and his boys go to the churches, find the best singers, put them together, and then in the front line, because they were afraid of the accent being a bit not non-Malay, in the front line on the melody, then get Malays to sing it.
Interesting. You know, though, one of the problems for me personally when looking into history is that I get into this moment of romanticization. You know, oh my God, Malays were dancing at that point. Oh my God, there was just, especially now, right, given the cynical and dead end sense of politics, we tend to look for clues on what's possible in the past, right? How did you deal with that? Because I think it's very human, especially to go back into the past. Different media, different resources. And it feels like we're traveling to a different country, right? And sometimes we tend to project certain innocence or a certain way. So how do you deal with that, right? Sometimes nostalgia can be tempting for the sense of romanticism that it brings.
Romanticism and nostalgia, yes, that's always a danger. Romanticism, nostalgia, nationalism, and patriotism. These things are the ultimate danger. Of course, though, these songs were all about pop songs, love songs, songs of romance, songs of patriotism. The sentiment you cannot... the sentiment is true. The use of that sentiment, whether by government or by others to wield influence, is the thing that I watch out for, really.
Especially in the liberal sphere, which I belong to, right? We tend to say, oh, things were so much better back then. Look at how things were much simpler, we were more harmonious, and so on. But I think it's true to an extent. But like you said, it was independence, post-war uncertainties, the communist insurgency was happening. We weren't really sure if Malaysia as a project would stay intact for long because you had unrest all over the region. Decolonization just happened. Can we imagine a world without empire? Yeah, there was optimism, but there was also anxieties as well, you know. And sometimes we look back, we forget that, they were human too. Yes, they had these interesting things happening, but it's probably a lot of trepidation, a lot of doubts too on where the country was going to go. But you know, when we project in the past, we don't talk about those things. You know, we talk about, the harmony. And I think to a certain extent, they had a lot more going for them than today, for example, like just in terms of enjoyment, open enjoyment, you know. So I think that's my problem. Typically, when I look back, I get into this moment of, wow, look at how things were so good. But then I check myself and I go, well, it's probably not as simple. There are probably all those other fears that we don't see, you know, like...
A lot of shit was happening then. Even when you talk about enjoyment and dancing and things, that was heavily prescribed. Good girls didn't do that. I mean, you know, the sort of girls who did that were basically people you bought tickets to dance with. So even recently when I was talking to Pak Samad Syed, asking him about Selena and how that whole thing came, and trying to romanticize myself, the Perempuan Joget, he said, straight, he said, look, Perempuan Joget were, you know, I mean, sex workers, basically prostitutes was the word he used. And so, no, you can't do that. And that was the way it was. So when we look back on these days, we are thinking of the rose-tinted bits. But doing the research, I learned that people were frozen in Radio Malaya. I mean, Johar Bahar, he was sent to cold storage. Wow. And he wrote some of our most beautiful Kroncong songs. So much treachery and backstabbing and everything happened, which actually created an alternative history that I tried to write about, which deviates from the official history, that made me think that actually, in the end, humans are humans whichever decade, and the that they do then is the they do now.
Oh, you know, what you just said suddenly somehow brings to mind this persistent underlying theme in Malay popular culture, and that is the marginalization of the seniman. It's all over Piramli's work, right? Ibu Mertuaku, Antara Dua Darjah, Anakku Sazali, right? Where the musician is looked down on. And that ties into what you just said about how, yes, on one hand, it's exciting, the emergence of this new popular culture, new sense of space, new sense of like embodiment, people relating to another in these new rhythms. But at the same time, like you said, not everybody was as excited about that prospect, right? Even Jamal Abdullah up to the 80s has a song called Tangisan Seniman, you know? So this was not just a 50s, 60s thing. It's this idea that the seniman is never quite embraced. That, yes, we want you for your music, but not for your power, right? Do you sense that as well? Or is that just a Piramli thing? I
mean, gosh, I know that from a personal...
Of course, yeah.
Out of the limelight, into the rain, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. You will be taken into the St. Regis and you'll be taken into the top places that they want Philharmonic... Petronas. But after the function is over, and after the photographs have been taken, you are shown your way and they go out their way, mm-hmm, in those mm-hmm. carpets where the ankle, you plunge into ankle deep. That cross section though, that juxtaposition of royalty and privileged people on the one hand and seniman and how they can be useful, has existed through the ages. Until today we have that phenomenon where television announcers marry the aristocracy, mm-hmm. blue bloods, as it were, and are catapulted into that world. And then their friends meet aristocratic people at the same functions. Mm-hmm. And I'm always very amused to see that juxtaposition.
Popular culture is such a resource for understanding our world. You know, I feel that I do some work in looking at alternative media in the 80s. Alternative, I don't mean like opposition media, but media that's informal, that doesn't have ISBN quotes or whatever, and there's so much going on. And I feel that, yes, we do talk a lot about official documents, archives, newspaper reports, right? But we don't look at necessarily how music is history, how fashion is history. You know, so I think this is where your contribution is very, very key. And this brings me to my other question. What was it like as a non-academic without necessarily the institutional, designations or credentials to be doing essentially like a book-length project like this? I mean, did you feel daunted at first, or you didn't think about it and you just went with it? Like, what was it like?
Well, I didn't know what it was to be an academic, so I didn't know what I was deprived of, I suppose. The thing is, though, in Malaysia today, what astounded me about this project was how much history is out there ready for the taking. So you walk into anybody's home, and I think not just me, but many other people I know who are doing stuff like this. For example, Mahen Bala in his project Kretapi, Ezrina Marwan. You walk into somebody's home, if they can be persuaded to open their cupboards to you and show their photo albums or their stuff, history is right there. And it amazes me that we have so much in terms of resources and funding given to the same old subject. For example, at Aswara, P. Ramlee, there's a whole P. Ramlee department. Now, for goodness sakes, in that same decade that P. Ramlee was created, there was Alfonso Soliano, there was Saiful Bahri, there was Johar Baha, there was Hamza Dolmat. These are just to name a few. Alias Arshad, the first Malayan director of the police band. Where's the research on him? This mm-hmm. is a fellow who was... who turned up at the Gurney police headquarters not knowing how to read a single note of music.
Wow.
He was selected to go to England because he was musical, and within a month of arriving, had to conduct 250 musicians of the Military School of Music in Britain doing opera. Now, talk about being a fish out of water. He graduated first in his year. He passed out first in his year and came back to lead the police band. Mm-hmm. Now, people, alias Arshad, created a lot of good music. Where's that?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
yes, I lacked resources maybe in terms of not being able to show a card that showed I was from a university or maybe not having a doctor behind my name. Mm-hmm. But having said that, when it comes to primary research, people don't care about that.
Yeah.
They just want to talk to you, you know,
mm-hmm.
and tell. And so much storytelling had to happen. It was almost like they were purging themselves of a whole lifetime of neglect.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a problem at all. There was more than I could handle with. And this book, which was supposed to take one year, actually took 2 years, and it only scratched the surface.
Interesting. So what are the lines of inquiry that you're considering to pursue now? I mean, I'm sure, I mean, typically when you produce a book, when you do research, there's a lot that you get caught into, but unfortunately have to put aside, right? You go, oh my God, that's fascinating, but I have to like really shelf this for a while, right? And for me, the list is getting longer, but what are the questions that you're keen to pursue after you're okay with this project?
On this subject, I'll be very frank and say none. That 2 years talking to 80-year-olds made me so sad and depressed. It took more than a year
sad.
To climb
Why?
Out of that. Every time you walk into an 80-year-old's house and you're surrounded by their life's collection of memorabilia and you listen to them, the things which were done to them, you imagine for yourselves the passion with which they created mm-hmm. that music and served their country and the condition in which they find themselves now with complete 100% neglect, save for $5,000 photo ops by interested political parties. Then for me, after a while, after 1 year, it really gets to you.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, you have that music still here. On the other hand, staring at you in the face right today is the neglect of our cultural custodians with that music. Then you look at the people themselves, the terrible circumstances they find themselves in. They're neglected, they're not acknowledged, and worst of all, they're in ill health and have no money to actually treat themselves. So you talk about passion. You talk about neglect of our organizations, it leads to a state of depression.
Yeah, because research, no matter how objective you are, is always personal. You're always emotionally invested in your discoveries, you know, and I can imagine how when you repeatedly encounter people who are marginalized, people who are underappreciated by history, it can take a toll on you at the level of your hopes and ideals of, you know, what you hope for your work to say. What is the problem exactly? I wonder about this as well. I mean, popular culture history, I can imagine, is overlooked. But you can see the similar oversights in other aspects of history as well. And we had a civilization too. I mean, it's not that there's nothing to discover. And one of the theories I have is that because we never really built universities in the way that a lot of other civilizations did. You know, that as we were growing, this I'm thinking back to like the good old days of like an empire or something, but there was never that culture of archiving, of valuing history to begin with. And maybe that was where we erred. I mean, I'm being very speculative right now, but as a researcher, knowing what you know, having gone through what you go through, what do you tell yourself when you ask, why isn't history being more valued?
I went to the Museum Negara over the weekend. It says that Malacca was founded in 1400. If you go to the state of Malacca, however, with its many, many museums, all funded by the state, it says that Malacca was founded in 1262. Now, that's more than a century's difference. These are our official versions of history, and that tells you how little we care for our history's veracity. For me, this is an age of investigation. Everybody out there who now has access to Google and can look up stuff for themselves is able to be a historian. For me, just as many things are being democratized, for example, music making, historians and the research of history is being democratized now. And I think because our custodians have been seen to be so neglectful of the history that they dole out to us, now it really is time for us to find out our own history. How can Malacca, which is the very fount of the legitimacy of the royal families, how can they be so wrong? Was it created in 1400 or was it created in 1262? Mm-hmm. If it was 1262, it couldn't have been Parameswara. Mm-hmm. So who was it? Now that to me tells me what a load of nonsense we're being fed when it comes to history. History books are changing every single decade. Mm-hmm. The Hang Tuah and all that. Historians can't decide. So how is it that we as Malaysians don't know who wrote the lyrics to our national anthem? How is it that we cannot access the hundreds of compositions which people submitted, including, I'm sure, Johar Baha, P. Ramlee, mm-hmm. the people of the caliber of Saiful Bahri, for that competition of the national anthem? Where are they? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why didn't we keep them? Why did we just throw them? When Dol Ramlee and Ahmad Marikan created hundreds and hundreds of recordings during the time they were in Radio Malaya, they labelled it, never erase this. Mm-hmm. Today, you cannot find those recordings. Mm-hmm. At one point in the 1960s, our recordings were the most famous in this region because the British actually set up a very good system. Mm-hmm. Today, mm-hmm. you can find maybe 4 or 5 reels out of the hundreds and hundreds of reels. There were 60,000 recordings at one point.
Wow.
Yes, those were just thrown away. When I spoke to people and asked, they said, oh, it was because there wasn't enough room in the stores. And I think people, I won't mention names, but people can show you today photographs of how today records are being thrown out after they've been digitized.
Wow.
Anybody who knows music will know that the digitization is not at the stage now where you want to throw out your LPs.
Exactly.
In fact, worldwide, there's a swing back into vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells you the utter neglect is a kind word of what is happening to our musical heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So when you ask me about the role of history, I would say to people out there, guys, if you ask anybody near you, any 80-year-old, they've still got memories. You can find out anything you want about your family and about your own culture. So do it.
Yeah. And on that note too, I want to add that history doesn't have to be distant. Even recent history is still valuable. History is always being made anyway. I mean, 3 months ago is history. I mean, even your little neighborhood street in Shah Alam will have histories, right? The demographics that change, the flow of migrant labor that, you know, colors the atmosphere a certain way, so on and so forth. All these things is the continuous reshaping of our world, you know, and just being attentive, even at the mundane level where the changes are, I think goes a long way. I mean, because time is always moving fast, and one day we're going to keep facing that question, what happened, you know? So I think, like you say, it's a really exciting time now. We have the technology, we have the discourse. You know, people are curious, people are raising the questions. So you have every opportunity to extend the conversation, you know. But I think you've set a really, really great example through this book, through your work as well. Now, how can our listeners reach you? Are you on Twitter?
No, I'm not.
No.
I'm on Facebook.
You're on Facebook? I suppose they can look you up and drop you a message if they want to ask further questions. Or they can email the show. It's bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Look us up on Facebook as well. Just type BFM Night School on the search space. Be sure to like our page. Saida, your book is called Rosalie and Other Love Songs. It was published by Kazana. How can somebody get a hold of this?
As it happens, I'm working on a Malay version, a translation into Bahasa Malaysia, and that should be available in the middle of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So when that comes out, it'll be available in all bookshops. At the moment, this copy is only available as a corporate gift from Khazana.
Is there a way you can buy online, maybe on Khazana's website or something like that? No,
Well,
we look forward to that edition that's coming up soon. I just found out about this and it's amazing. I mean, it's just the documents in it and the anecdotes and the photos. And again, I like it that you embed music into the changes of society and history, you know, because you see it really come to life that way. So I'm looking forward to read this. But thanks again for joining us. This is not going to be the last time you're on the show. I think there's a lot more we can unpack with regards to, I mean, history is just endless, right? So we'd love to have you over again.
Thank you.
That was a really lovely conversation. Be sure to download our app. BFM has all the shows on it that you can follow regularly. If you miss any, including this one, you can go to the Apple App Store or Google Play and be sure to look for the app there. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined this week by a musician, historian, lawyer Saidah Rastam, and we were talking about the alternative histories of Malaysian pop culture. And this is Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.